Have you ever been asked to do a task that made no sense to you? Probably everyone has at some point, especially when we're younger, with our limited knowledge of life, experiences, and so forth. Our parents can ask us to do something, and we may not be able to see the context or the long-term reason, and so it just doesn't make sense. This can also happen, although, when we're older as well. We are focused on our own life, and when we're presented with something outside of our normal view of life, we can miss the reason why something can be important. Spiritually, it can be the same way. Sometimes God can ask us to do something that makes no sense to us. This is the challenge that many have when they run across, if you will, some of God's instruction. But we can see examples of this even in Scripture. I've often wondered what Noah thought about when he was told to build the ark. Okay, he saw all the evil around him, but there's no indication that something like that had ever been created, ever been built. And then the time it took to build it. And then God bringing the animals. And then him preaching for 120 years, and no one outside his family responded. What about Abraham when he was told to sacrifice Isaac? There were nations around him, peoples that practiced human sacrifice because they believed wrongfully that if I gave of my own life, if I gave fruit of my life to the gods, then they had to do what I asked because they saw it as so valuable. And yet Abraham was told to go do this, and it doesn't seem that he questioned it much. I'm sure he had his thoughts. But even as they approached the mountain, he was reassuring Isaac that God would provide a sacrifice, that all of this would come out the way God needed it to. And yet he still raised the knife, didn't he? What about Israel as a nation when they were penned down before the Red Sea? Pharaoh had pursued them. They had left with a high hand, as it says. They were so happy to finally be free, to not be slaves, be told every day what they could do, what they couldn't do, how long they had to work, the brutal conditions that just literally wore them out. And yet, there he is again, and they've got mountains on both sides. They've got this huge body of water in front of them, and Moses is saying, stand still, and it makes no sense. What about the disciples when they were told to wait in Jerusalem till the day of Pentecost, when the promise would come? Did they really understand what that meant? These examples involve actions, primarily. But what about the principles of following his instruction? There's the account of man going back to Israel's history as they came out of Egypt. The man that was, well, the whole nation was told, on Friday, gather a double portion of the manna, because I don't want you doing that on the Sabbath. And the man that didn't believe God, and so he went out on the Sabbath to gather manna. There was no manna. God was not very happy with that because he had doubted him and disobeyed his instruction. There's the record of Saul. We turn to that section just in the sermonette. Not listening to God's instruction through his prophet Samuel. And that was the beginning of the end for Saul. It cost him his kingship. What about us personally? As God calls and works with us, do we come to see many things he asks us to do? Because as I mentioned, as we came into contact with the church, there were probably a lot of things that didn't make sense to us. The Sabbath doesn't make any sense when the world is geared around the weekend, especially. And Saturday is seen as probably the prime day of the week to do whatever you want to do, or to work extra hours, or to all these things. The food laws don't make any sense. It's all food. But we understand why later on. I'll come to that. The holy days don't make sense initially either. Some will deride them as instruction only given to ancient Israel. It's no longer necessary. But all of this instruction and more reveals to us not only aspects of God's character, but also what it means for us to become holy and what God is working out to bring about salvation to all who will desire it. The principle of tithing is similar. Tithing makes no sense. I remember my first full-time job, part-time job, but regular work. Teenager at McDonald's, that money seemed to accumulate very slowly. And then you have to take a 10% off the top. And then after you understand that, you realize there's another 10% that you're supposed to set aside so that you can come before God on his holy days. We typically think of that as the Feast of Tabernacles, but it's for all of those days. The expenses of coming before him, the loss of income during that time, if you will, if it's on a weekday. And then every third year to set aside another tenth for those that struggle to take care of themselves. They don't have the means. How does tithing make sense? And that's what we're going to look at today. I'm going to do a review of the doctrine of tithing, and we're going to answer the question, why is tithing important? So let's begin Scripture in Deuteronomy 14. God gives this instruction to Israel, but this is not the first time we encounter tithing in Scripture. Abraham tithed, and the indication is that those that followed him, his descendants, because it says they listened and followed in Abraham's footsteps, that they did the same thing. But here he's speaking to the nation. In Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, God speaking through Moses said, "You shall surely tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year." So the simple answer to the question, why is tithing important, is because God says so. He says to do it. But that doesn't make sense, does it? As I mentioned, we can struggle. This is the struggle we have humanly, because it doesn't make sense. It requires trust. Trust that God will do what he says he will is going to do without understanding the why. And here's another great spiritual principle that we come up against. I am convinced that obedience almost always follows, or precedes, I should say, precedes understanding. Obedience almost always precedes understanding. My desire today is not to go through the mechanics of tithing, but rather the principle of why. But to make sure we all understand what we're talking about here, tithing, or specifically the word tithe itself, simply means to give or take a tenth of. God is a very generous God. And in asking, he only asks for a tenth of the increase. Not a tenth of everything, tenth of the increase. Whether that's in the form of a harvest, as we read here in Deuteronomy 14:22, or whether it's an increase if you're raising animals, or in a more modern sense, you're having income from a job someone's paying you to do, or property that we have, anything of this nature. God expects us to tithe as recognition of him being creator and possessor of all. Because all that we use to live, all that we use to enjoy life, all that exists, all came from God in the first place. This is his generosity. He allows us free use of everything he's created. And for that use, he simply asks acknowledgement that he gives us everything. So let's back up here in Deuteronomy to chapter 8. Deuteronomy 8, and in verse 18. We read here again, as God says to the nation, "You shall remember the Eternal your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." The power to get wealth. By the very act of tithing, we are in effect worshiping God. And that may be part of the disconnect that many have, because they see it as a loss, right? It's 10% cut off the top. I don't get to use any of that. Rather than looking at it and saying, I have the opportunity to worship God with what he has given me. And so we acknowledge God as the source of our existence, the providence and the blessings that we have. Let's look at this to kind of reinforce the point in the book of Haggai. Haggai chapter 2. One of the dichotomies, if you will, in Israel's history was that the further they got away from God, the more it seemed that they were blessed. They had material wealth. And they didn't stop to consider that that would stop at some point. And unfortunately, there are parallels with this nation today, because we have great wealth in this country, don't we? Unprecedented wealth in many respects. And yet we're probably further away from God as a nation than we've ever been. But again, in Haggai 2 and verse 8, we read this. God, speaking through the prophet Haggai here, says, the silver is mine, the gold is mine, says the Eternal of Hosts. It's all his to begin with. This is what God sought to, part of what God sought to have Job understand. Because at the end of Job, you know, we have this story of these friends that were not friends, and the one young man that was not recognized having wisdom, but probably the wisest of them all. And Job goes through this whole unfortunate set of circumstances that just wear him out. And yet at the end, he's trying to defend himself before God, and God says, okay, where were you when I did this, when I made this? How do you know when the animals are to do this and that and the other? And Job had to realize that he wasn't in charge of anything, really. And so even here, looking at wealth, such as gold or silver, and look at what mankind has done to accumulate some of this wealth over the millennia. If you want to write in your notes, Exodus 19, verses 5 to 6, God says a very similar thing there, expanding out, if you will, the macro view of saying, the whole earth is mine. God created it, it's his. And in setting aside Israel as a model nation, God had hoped to show them that lasting blessings come through obedience, and through obedience they could begin to take on his holiness. So we see then, in turning to Leviticus 27, that tithe then becomes holy. I have asked the question a number of times. I'm sure many of you know the answer, because we've covered it before, but what makes anything holy? God's presence. Right? This day is not holy because we're here. It's holy because God is here. Our tithe then becomes holy once it becomes God's again. In Leviticus 27 and verse 30, we read this: all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or the fruit of the tree, is the Eternal's. It is holy to the Lord. It no longer is simply cash in our modern sense of wealth and money and economics and so forth. It's something now that becomes holy. Do we consider our tithes holy? If we see them as holy, then we don't see it as a loss of income. We don't see it as an obligation. We don't see it as something we have to perform. We see it as an act of worship, as I mentioned earlier, because it is acknowledging what is holy to God. I mentioned Job. Let's just go ahead and turn there. Job 41. Job was fabulously wealthy too, wasn't he? One of the unfortunate things about great wealth, and I've been around a few people in the course of my lifetime that were pretty wealthy, and it's the rare individual who can have wealth and be humble and not greedy. You would think once you get a certain level, there's no need to be greedy because you pretty much have the money to do whatever you want. But it never seems to be enough, humanly. It's never enough. I always want more. Job was fabulously wealthy, and yet God removed all that, didn't he? Job was very healthy, and he removed that. He had this loving, great extended family. He removed that. He had all these servants to do work for him, and he removed all that. And so in Job 41, in verse 11, God says this to me: who has preceded me that I should pay him? You know, even if I created all these things, was there another God before me that then I should do these things for him? He says, everything under heaven is mine. And to use the term again, this is the macro view. This is everything under his heaven, everything in the universe, everything he's created. The tithing then is also about not losing sight of God's sovereignty and the respect that we should remember to give him in these things. Some view tithing, as I mentioned, as this loss that God, in many respects, wants to limit our wealth or increase. And that may be how we humanly, carnally see it at first. But if we try to explain tithing to someone unfamiliar with it, they're probably going to say something along the line is, you know, how in the world am I going to get along with 10, 20, 30% less of my income. First tithe, second tithe, every third year, a third tithe. And if you try to do it on paper, it will not work. Because it doesn't. I mean, you're setting aside money, and then it's gone, right? It's not yours anymore. I remember the first year my parents went through a third tithe year. And at least where I grew up in the Cincinnati area, the principle of determining your third tithe year was based off when you were baptized. Some others did it differently. I don't know that that's critical. I think more to the point that you're doing it. So they enter their third tithe year, and someone in the congregation talking about this encouraged them to keep track of all the exceptional blessings, the things beyond the ordinary that they could explain that would just come to them. And they stopped after about a month because it was just thing after thing. And it wasn't suddenly, you know, this cash falling from heaven. It was the things of blessing that more than made up for things like cash. They realized that they were not losing anything, that God was blessing them beyond. And this is the beautiful thing about how God operates. We heard about God being love and everything about him expressing that. So even in tithing, we can see it as a loss, but he more than makes up for it. It's not a quid pro quo thing. But that can be hard to convince people of, can't it? Tithing also shows God how willing we are to put him first. Because the problem, and I'll put that in quotes, the problem with money is you don't need help, right? You don't need anybody else. Money does solve problems. Money can take care of a lot of things in life. But if you've ever studied some of the great wealthy ones, especially going back into our country's history in the early 1900s, those they called the robber barons, just fabulous wealth. And yet, almost to a man, they all said towards the end of their lives that they would just get rid of all of it for the sake of whatever it was. J. Paul Getty, I think, had like 7 or 8 marriages. And he said, I would give it all away to have one good marriage. So in the end, it didn't give them what they thought it would give them. But let's look at Malachi chapter 3. In spite of the instruction that we read in Leviticus and Deuteronomy earlier, and the instruction that God gave to Israel through his servants, by the time of roughly 400 BC, Israel as a nation were not tithing the way they should. They had kind of corrupted it. And unfortunately, it had become corrupted because the priests were not teaching the nation the way they should have been. Now, you would think the priests would have a vested interest in teaching tithing, because how did the priests get paid? Through the tithes. And then the priests tithed to the high priest. But yet they were not teaching tithing, which means what? They were getting money somewhere else, which meant they weren't doing their priesthood properly. They were getting it through bribes. They were getting it through other things. So Malachi 3 and verse 7, God brings this to a point. He says, from the days of your fathers, you have gone away from my ordinances. One of the interesting things about this book of Malachi is it's called a monologue dialogue. So God is the only one talking, but he's talking as if he's having a conversation with Israel, because he knows what they're going to say. So he says, you've strayed from my ordinances, you've not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Eternal of Hosts. But you say, in what way shall we return? We're good. What have we done wrong? We're not doing anything wrong. So then he says in verse 8, will a man rob God? And so then they say, how have we robbed you? How do you rob God? You can rob God in a lot of ways. You can rob him by not giving him the respect and the honor he deserves. We can rob him of our obedience, our submission. So he answers the question in verse 8, in tithes and offerings. But again, is God interested in our money? What does Dad want? He wants obedience, not just because he needs to rule. He needs obedience because he knows what it brings. He needs obedience so that we learn how to become like him. So he says in verse 9, because you have not paid tithes and offerings, you are cursed with a curse. For you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this. Now, they would pay tithes to the priests. The priests would collect this money, and it would be used in service towards God. And what such thing oftentimes would be in some of these offerings, especially, that would be given on the holy days and other occasions. But does God need our food? Again, he created everything, didn't he? He could turn around in an instant, create all the sheep that he needed for a sacrifice, or whatever it was. But it's not about that, is it? It's about their involvement. He says, you do this, and let me show you what I will do. He says, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. I still remember a photo when I was a very young boy, probably 6 or 7 or so, and I don't remember where the photo was, if it was a magazine or where, but it showed farmers that had gathered the fall crop. It was probably corn, it might have been wheat, but something along that line, and there was so much that they had harvested. They didn't have enough silos for it, so they were pouring it down Main Street of this little town. Just a pile of it down the road. There was just so much they couldn't even store it until they could get it in railroad cars and get it to other places and such. That's what I think about when I think about a verse like this. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing. Now the problem again, the thing that we can struggle to understand that doesn't make sense to us is when we hear this, what do you think? Money, right? You think money. Because this is what our society, our culture is based on. But the blessings, as I oftentimes say, the blessing of the thing that never happened. Right? The car that doesn't break down. You know, again, I remember in the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s, the husbands, the dads, before the Feast of Tabernacles, they would all gather at somebody's home and they would have a car maintenance party. Right? Everybody would work on their cars together. They'd pull up a car and somebody was changing the oil and somebody was checking the brakes and somebody was, you know, whatever. They'd work on each other's car so that everything was in shape to go to the feast. Because cars back then were not as sophisticated as cars now. The tolerances weren't even the same. And so to get a car to last 100,000 miles, that was huge. If you don't have a car that lasts 100,000 miles now, you bought a junker. Right? Because they're designed to go 200,000, 300,000 miles now. But the blessing of that, cars that should have never made it to the feast and back, that's one such thing. What about the blessing of understanding what our purpose in life is? The peace that comes with not knowing that we have to chase things or to be overly concerned about things. Again, I mentioned my parents' blessings that I saw them receive. And things that you can't explain any other way except God's intervention. I mentioned the great harvests, you know, the gardens that we're blessed with, the blessing of employment, the blessing in health. And I suspect every one of you would have your own stories. But if I have a conversation with someone that is struggling in this regard, I try to remind them that in tithing especially, it is impossible to outgive God. And I have a great story from a family that I knew in New England decades ago. They had stopped attending when Worldwide Church of God imploded. And they had only been out for a handful of years. They just went back into the world doing their own lives. But in doing so, financially, their life fell apart. They were always struggling. He had a decent job with the state, but it was never enough. And so they came into church, started reattending again with United, and they were a lovely family, but they still continued to struggle. And they would come to the church occasionally for assistance of one form or another, and they were making use of other programs, whether it was food banks or clothing drives or whatever. They were accessing those things to have what they needed, but it was still never enough. And so they had come often enough that the pastor had asked me to have the conversation with them. And so at that point, to sit down and say, okay, well, let's just look at your finances. And that's something I still do. You can do a simple budget sheet. What's your income? What's your outgo? You know, what are you spending money on? And as I suspected, it came up that they were not tithing. And the husband said, we can't afford to tithe. And I said, you can't afford not to tithe. So to his credit, he'd been looking for other jobs. He ideally wanted to stay in the state system, if you will, because he had already put in enough time that if he put in another 10, 15 or so years, he would be vested in the program, he'd get retirement, all of these things. So he was trying to stay in the state employment field, but he would go for interviews, and like many companies, you know, they can post internally first before it goes outside. And so he would pay attention to those things, and he would interview, he would put in resumes, he might get an interview, he might get a second interview, they would all just vanish, never amounted to anything. So he's getting a bit dejected, but I said, here's the thing, I don't know how and I don't know when God will bless you, but I know he will. I've seen it enough. So just keep doing what you're supposed to be doing, and it will come. And then some few months later, he came to me and explained that he'd gotten a new job in the state. And it was a little bit more pay, not a lot, almost kind of a lateral move. But the bonus was that instead of living in Concord, New Hampshire, which is the capital, which is the most expensive place to live in New Hampshire, if you can imagine New Hampshire being expensive, the job was in a different part of the state, which meant his cost of living went down, which meant his income coming into the house went up, right? Because now you don't have all those expenses up front. And so a little thing like that, and now suddenly they don't have to ask church for any money along the way now. They've got enough money to cover their expenses, and they're starting to gain traction, if you will. So let's look at Luke chapter 11 next. No, I'm sorry, Matthew 23. Got ahead of myself there a little bit. Matthew 23. One of the comments, if you go into commentaries or if you listen to any theologians, preachers from the mainstream Christian perspective, is they say, there is no instruction in the New Testament for tithing, so we don't have to do it. I don't know how they get that, because there is instruction in the New Testament about tithing. It's just not as direct as it is in the Old Testament. It's not as replete as it is in the Old Testament. But Matthew 23, we have one such example here. Christ is really taking to task here in this chapter especially, the Pharisees. If you count up the number of times he uses the expression woe in here, and woe is not just kind of, wait, hold up. Woe is, you are being stupid. Stop and listen to me. This is a very direct, very blunt, very strong admonition. They're way off mark. So he says here in verse 23, woe to you scribes, Pharisees, you're hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin. Anybody ever seen those seeds? It's like glitter, right? You drop it on the floor, it's everywhere. And it is so small, you'll never get it all back. Right? So what were the scribes and the Pharisees doing that was hypocritical? They would literally count out every seed, which is tedious. Think of the time that it took. I mean, I kind of jokingly say, the way I would do is I'd put it all on a scale. It weighs so much. Divide that by three. Get roughly that amount. Throw a little bit more in, and you're done, right? Because the principle is honoring God. They were worried they would give too much, right? So I'm going to make sure I measure it, count it out so I don't give more than I have to. So he says, you're doing this. Notice, you pay tithe of these things, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, which are justice, mercy, and faith. The law is to lead us to the weightier things. But without the law, you don't have the weightier things, right? Because then we go all kinds of directions. But notice what he says here. These you ought to have done, the judgment, mercy, faith, these you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. What is the others? Paying tithe of mint, anise, and cumin. So Christ here defines, no, tithing's not done away. He didn't release mankind from this burden of tithing, but rather shows us that it leads to something deeper. This is the other aspect, going back to obedience preceding understanding. Because we're never going to get to judgment, mercy, faith if we don't follow God's instruction, part of which is tithing, as we're discussing here today. But we need to make sure we're doing it properly, as was even rehearsed in the sermonette. Do we tithe out of habit? Do we tithe because it's an obligation? It's something we check off a list. Okay, I got that done. God's going to have to bless me this next week. Do we fall in the trap of saying, I can't afford to tithe, like I mentioned earlier? We can do that sometimes. We get behind financially and we think, okay, well, you know what? That's 10%. I'll make it up next month. And I've seen people get behind very quickly on these things. Maybe we view it as just any other bill. But let's look at Luke 11 next. This is very similar to what Christ covered in Matthew 23, but there's a little bit more here as well. Luke 11 and in verse 42. Christ says here, but woe to you Pharisees, for you pay tithe of men, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass by justice and the love of God. Tithing, as again was already covered earlier today, is showing God our love. Do we love God enough to do this? Notice again, he says, these you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. The Pharisees, if they ever understood it, they had forgotten the point of tithing. They saw it as a checklist thing, which is most of what they did, right? If I do this, then God owes me. If I do this, I'm righteous. He can't punish me. So even in going back to Job's example, what was it that his friends said in various forms, one way or the other? You've sinned. This is why you had all this happen to you. You sinned. So God's punishing you. If you acknowledge the sin, then God can restore you. Well, the Pharisees were of the same mindset almost 1,000 years later. You know, so if we do these things, then we're righteous. God can't do anything we see as punishment. And they completely missed all these other things that we've already covered. They had reduced God to this minimalist obligation. So, again, we're to learn how to honor him with all that he's given us. We're to serve him and reflect him in all that we do with the wealth that he allows us to gather. We're to remember that the physical things are temporary. But becoming like him is eternal. That's a small price to pay, isn't it? To learn how to become like him. So we honor God with our tithes, with our offerings, with our presence on days such as the Sabbath day, the holy days, our obedience and instruction in his commandments. But again, let's look at how we are to do it, and that is, in principle, talked about in 2 Corinthians 9. Many times we'll cover this on a holy day as we're pondering the collection of an offering on that holy day. Because you can do something grudgingly, can't you? You can do something without understanding why. You have no sense of why. And if we do that long enough, we can begin to resent it. Well, God doesn't want us to resent it. 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 7, we read here as Paul says, let each one of you give as he purposes in his heart. The Corinthian congregation had their own hot mess, right? They had their own problems. They were still God's people, and one of the very positive things was that they had seen and heard from Jerusalem how they were not doing well. They were in a tough strait because the Jews as a nation, as people, kept poking and pushing against the Roman authorities, and so the economy in Roman Palestine was not as good as it was in some other areas. And so they wanted to send them money. They wanted to send them food. They wanted to send them support. And so Paul's reminding them, look, do this. That's good that you're doing it. But do it with a cheerful heart, not grudgingly or of necessity. I have to. If I must, okay. He says, don't do it that way. For he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. And I would say even more bountifully. Because again, it's not just that God restores, he gives more. In various ways, he gives more. He wants us to tithe then with a willing heart as well. Notice verse 8. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, always having all sufficiency, in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. So it's not just enough, it's abundance. The official statement of the United Church of God in our fundamental belief booklet on tithing says this: we believe in tithing as a way of honoring God with the substance, with our substance, and as a means of serving him in preaching the gospel, care of the church, attending the festivals, and helping the needy. So tithing is a fundamental part of being a true Christian. And even if most of Christianity doesn't see the value in it, there are people that do see it in Scripture and do follow it, and they see the blessings that come from it as well. But if we ignore tithing, then we lose out on more fully understanding God and what he desires for us. So many spiritual blessings are predicated, again, on acceptance and application, not only of this doctrine, but all that God teaches us. And he does that so that, again, we learn to become like him, to value what he values. We tithe because God asks us to, so we're reminded of what he does, what he provides for us. We tithe because it's about honoring God and recognizing that we owe him everything, and that what he provides to us that we tithe back is holy, and it's his to begin with. So let's remember why we are to tithe.